Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kaveh Kavusi, and I'll be discussing a diverse array of subjects that span from my experiences in the emergency room to the furthest reaches of the universe. I'll be hosting guests, inviting illuminating conversations that at times may challenge ways of thinking or being, while also nurturing curiosity, meaning, and awe into life. Please consider subscribing, liking, saving, or sharing this podcast with any of your friends or family if it feels right for you. Thank you for taking the time. Let's dive into the podcast. This looks a little more sophisticated than the last time that we did it, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, this is going to be podcast number 9, but it was one that wanted to accelerate in putting out because there's something that is has a deadline for being released, so I thought it would be a great opportunity for us to discuss. Mm-hmm. This is Nico. For anyone who has made it through all of the podcast thus far, he's one of my homies, one of my close friends, one of my brothers that I have connected with over the past, I guess, 4 years now, and really supported each other. I felt at times where that was really difficult, especially feeling elements of loneliness or lone wolfing in particular with my line of work and how I was showing up in the world. In that time, Nico has been, well, he'll share what's been going on in his life, but in particular, he's got, I'm guessing, about 262 pages there in front of him with his book called Grace, A Practical, No Bullshit Journey from Pain to Purpose. I want to thank Nico for taking time to come here. We just spent some time in the hot tub, and now we're a little refreshed. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Yes, I am very happy.
Yeah.
Because as my birthday is coming up in a couple of days, which happens to be the exact day that my book is launching.
Which is what day?
Grace. January 26th, 2023, when this is being recorded. I cannot imagine a better way to celebrate my birthday than crossing this off my bucket list.
Yeah.
Things that I always wanted to do. And also knowing that I can die and a big chunk of what I think I know has been put into a means that other people can access. So there is already a sense of legacy that will outlive me. However long or brief, I don't know that. I can't know that.
You're speaking a little soon because how religion works, they'll come and they'll wipe out all of the books of deep insight so they can put theirs in particular there. So hopefully that day doesn't come. And I hope Canada is multicultural enough that there's no culture that can do that to the other.
You know,
colonialism.
It reminds me of Van Gogh. I don't know if you know the story of the artist.
I know how he lost an ear. That's about it.
Yeah. So a lot of people revere him, and some of his paintings have been the ones that have been sold for like tens of millions of euros and dollars. And if you ask a random person, most will say that, oh, yeah, Van Gogh is a great artist. But if you look at his life, it was terrible by most measures. If you could say that a life was a failure, if there was such a thing, by society's standards, he failed at all of it. Like when he was alive, he sold only one painting while he was alive, and it was to his brother. His brother bought a painting from him out of pity. And it was so bad, like he tried so many things and failed at all of them. And then eventually at the end of his days, he decided that he couldn't keep living like that. He also used to paint, and he used to lick the brushes, the paint brushes, clean. And paint has a lot of heavy metals, so he was a little bit mental because of the excessive
exposures.
Metal in his brain. And he decided to kill himself, so he grabbed a shotgun, walked out of the barn and into the fields, and was gonna blow his head off. And he I think he decided to shoot his stomach. And he shot himself, hoping to end it. And he just blew his intestines and was still alive. So he dragged himself back to the barn where his brother found him and took care of him for, I think, a few weeks before he finally passed away. So even trying to commit suicide, he failed.
Yeah.
And his last words were, "The pain will never end."
Uh-huh.
So I cannot imagine a worse way to live and to die than that.
Uh-huh.
A complete failure. And probably that's part of what makes his paintings something. I imagine that people who are really good, strong fans of his art, is because it encapsulates that grief of wanting, but
not his neurosis, and, yeah.
At the same time, you know, one of the greatest painters of, at least the most recognized and celebrated of history, at least our current history. Yet when he was alive, he was failure. His experience of being a painter was one of scarcity, of not being known, not of his artwork not being wanted. And then some years after he died, he started gathering all that. So who knows what is best? Would you rather have mild success while you're alive, or exponential one and impact once you're gone?
Well, a few things come up there. Is, did you write this book for others to receive it, or did you write it as a testament for yourself to connect with you, relative immortalization? And did you discover aspects of yourself that otherwise you wouldn't have come upon if you hadn't written this?
A mix of both. There's no way to engage in a creative endeavor without the process of creation also impacting us. Yeah, that's why they call it recreation. You know, when you're having fun creating something, you create something and that recreates you. It doesn't mean that it only entertains you, but you're transformed by the process. How involved you are in the process defines how transformed you are by it. And this is true anywhere in life. You're involved in your work, you're bound to be transformed by it. Whether you're cleaning toilets or you're a neurosurgeon, if you're involved, it's going to transform you. The same way a relationship, you're involved in it, your partner can be very flat in most measures. They may be ugly or uneventful. And I say ugly in the way of being, not necessarily physically ugly. There may be people who are quite dull that you think, oh, there's no drama, no excitement, no highs, no lows. I have nothing to learn here. If you're deeply involved in that relationship, it's going to transform you.
Yeah.
So, yes, I was very involved in the writing of this book.
Mm-hmm.
And my intention is, well, would I have written it if I lived in a deserted island? For sure not. So the purpose of creation, I feel, is to be shared. Like, what's the use of a singer with a celestial voice if nobody but him or her is ever going to listen to their singing? Sure, they can enjoy playing with their own voice, but ultimately it is only of value when the life around us finds value in it. So that was my guiding north.
Mm-hmm.
May this be a book that provides as much value as I have to give right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the second, may I find within myself enough involvement and presence and attention so that I may be transformed by it as well, so that I can clean my thinking, my writing, of course, structure a little bit more the way that I see life, and beyond that, sharpen up the areas where I had judgments, fears, doubts around writing a book too long, too short, too simple, nobody's gonna care. What if they don't like it? What, you know, all
everything
that
came up.
Yes, all that nonsense and overcoming that, I think, is a big part of the process.
Mm. Which one was the most dominant for you?
What do you mean?
In which one did you find was the biggest roadblock, or one that was in the way of you actually executing on the book? Because a lot of people think about writing a book, but they just don't pull the trigger. Then when you go to Indigo or some bookstore, you have this illusion that no, everybody's writing, but then you hear about so many people who want to and never do. Mm-hmm. For you, what was something that stood in the way?
The biggest thing was starting and having clarity. Like having a vague idea. I've had a vague idea about what I wanted to write about for years, maybe over a decade. So lack of clarity, I think, is the only thing that really stands in making a decision, any decision. And for me, the decision to write this book was, well, I'm not really sure about what message I want to give. Mm-hmm. And I started writing it without that being very clear. I had a vague feeling of what I wanted to convey. Mm-hmm. And the first draft that I sent to the publisher, it came back with a lot of structural feedback.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, we don't know what you're talking about. All the chapters are messy. There's no clean line. There's no a train of thought that can lead us anywhere.
Right.
You talk about this, you talk about this, you talk about this, but at the end of the day, I don't know what is this about? And that was confronting, but it also allowed me to go through the process of polishing things up on the go. So that was the hardest thing, being clear. And I think I think if there's total clarity, movement happens as a side effect. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you need a lot of courage, and that may harm you, right? If you're going to cross a highway and there's cars coming both ways very fast, what's going to help you get from one side to the highway to the other is clarity. You're going to see very clearly what's coming, and then you can cross effortlessly. You don't need willpower.
Please, nobody try that at home.
But if you don't see clearly, you better have a lot of confidence, because you're going to run blind into it, and a lot of luck as well. And I feel that a lot of times when it comes to making decisions, writing a book, joining a relationship, switching jobs, anything, we're stuck because we don't see clearly. Some people make it up with being overly confident, and that gets them somewhere, but sometimes it gets them also in trouble. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was I had a lot of confidence, yeah, I'm gonna do it, but not a lot of clarity. So I decided to still take the leap of faith and adjust along the way.
Right. Who did you write this for?
So,
and also, and if you want to intertwine in there, who isn't this for?
Yeah. So who I wrote it for is, I made it quite general, in the sense that I simplified the way in which I usually speak and write, so that language is not something that gets in the way of a person understanding it, a young person, an old person. It's a journey, practical journey from pain to purpose. Whoever has experienced pain, and the pain they have experienced has dented the way in which they navigate life, whether it is heavy trauma or whether it is mild and ways in which you feel stuck in situations, relationships, jobs, ways of feeling, ways of thinking, it can almost always be traced back to a point of pain in your life. So this book is for every person who has had an experience of pain that still lingers within them. Uh-huh. And has tried different ways to deal with it, therapy, maybe plant medicines, maybe yoga, maybe different things, and still feels stagnation when they're confronted with life. They go back into their old cycles. So it's a book that includes different tools to allow a person to move past points of stagnation.
Right.
Who it isn't for? Someone who feels that their pain is theirs, and they have created an identity very linked to their pain.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of people, unfortunately. Like, mm-hmm. if you feel that your pain defines you, and more importantly, if you feel that you were victimized
I'll clear that.
By life,
yeah,
by others, Not to say you weren't. In some cases, especially if you were a child and abuse was present, for sure, none of that was deserved. This is not about blame. This is about responsibility. A lot of people get this wrong when I share online the thing that I am, I think they call it victim shaming. Yeah. Like, no, I'm victim empowering. I think the shameful thing is to tell the victim that they're powerless to do or Absolutely. To undo what happened. I think the proper thing and the proper stance towards pain, especially when it is the kind of pain that it's undeserved, is responsibility. It's not, I dismiss what happened to you, it doesn't matter, your problem is your fault. No, but you are responsible. Sure, your house is on fire. Why is it on fire? Maybe your neighbor put it on fire. Maybe your parents, maybe far before you were born, your grandparents left the candle burning in some corner. Mm-hmm. Not to say your house burning is your
vessel, your life.
Yeah, no, but not to say that you're to blame for it. But if you see it burning, you are responsible. Meaning, you have to figure out, can I organize things, or do I have to run away from this house? Can I put things back in order? I don't know, call the firefighters. So this book is not for people who are comfortable in their stories of pain and who are unwilling to forgive or unwilling to consider the possibility of forgiveness. Like, if you're certain that somebody else wronged you and you're the way you are because your dad, your uncle, your mom, society, your ex-boyfriend, your neighbor, somebody did something to you, and you are not even willing to consider that that may not be the full truth, then this book is not for you. Mm. I'm not saying you have to think differently. No, the book is an invitation. We explore different perspectives.
Yeah.
So that if you feel you were a victim, you can understand, well, actually, maybe not so much, right? But there has to be enough curiosity to consider it.
Yeah.
If you're set that, if you're righteous, it's not for you.
Mm-hmm. That's a tricky one, because where you're starting from, if your starting point is the identity and the pain that's intertwined with it, it's almost like the eyes that see outward doesn't notice the eyeball itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult. You have to come upon a mirror for you to acknowledge the eye. The eye mm-hmm. being the pain, the eye being all the compensatory mechanisms, the behaviors, the people you've brought in your life to maybe not re-experience that pain or to control how that pain shows up in your life. So there's a lot of humility and challenge. I bet if you were to ask a good majority of people, do you identify deeply with your pain? Good portion of people may say, what the fuck does that even mean first?
Mm-hmm.
Then if there is the curiosity there, because it's intertwined with, I would think, elements of their culture, their upbringing, certain traumatic experiences, maybe it happened when they were younger, too young to really process and understand it. Now coming upon this, do you think someone who still doesn't meet the criteria and reads that book, do you think it invokes that level of curiosity for them to reconsider their identity specifically?
I think so. Perhaps through the words in the book, it may be difficult, because if you're so closed off or maybe so entangled with your history that you don't even know that you're carrying it in your present, and you're not willing to let it go,
mm-hmm.
then reading a few words on a piece of a tree is not gonna, it's unlikely to do much. It could perhaps plant some seeds, some considerations, but usually if your mind is closed, what you're reading, it's going through your mind and there's no opening there.
Mm-hmm.
However, and I did this right after the intro, I actually included a little thing that says, I understand that life gets in the way, and sometimes we pick up a new book with all the hopes and intentions and desires to finish it, but then work, family, health, everything, we're washed away by waves of duty, sometimes responsibility, commitments,
often justified.
Yes. Yeah. And the desire for transformation dies at the shelf of all good intentions.
Yeah.
it becomes another book that you have on your Kindle app or on your shelf that you perhaps checked a few pages of, a few chapters of, and then you got too busy to ever continue, and then you moved on. Mm-hmm. So right after the interest, if that's the case, at the very least visit, and I provide a link over there. And this for me is perhaps the most practical part of the book, and it's a link that gives people access to several different resources. And these are resources that they can implement immediately in their life, and resources that do not necessarily work with the mind.
Yeah.
So a person can go and sure of what they will get out of it and go through a meditation, through a breathwork session, through a certain process that is included there, and have a breakthrough. Maybe like a breaking in of their within their patterns and breaking through them. And this has happened in the past with some of these tools, that people come and they are almost, well, they have no expectations because they don't think anything is wrong to begin with.
Uh-huh.
And they go through a process and they come out of it on the other side with deeper awareness. And that awareness now understands, wow, I've been living a big lie. I've been mm-hmm. living in such a jail.
Yeah.
So yes, I feel the book will serve those people.
Mm.
Anyone who's willing to spend anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour going through the practical resources that are included, then they'll have a tangible lived experience of something deeper.
Right.
And I think that's all it takes, is like you're catching a little bit of fire. Now, that may be enough to carry your curiosity into a deeper work, into finishing the book, hopefully, into questioning a lot of things. Because now you felt something.
Mm-hmm.
You just didn't read somebody's thoughts on paper. Now you felt something, and that is yours. That didn't come from outside.
Yeah. I feel like it's important when we're speaking about this here, when we're talking about pain, maybe identifying some of the things that people, if they are still having difficulty recognizing, like, hey, I'm not hurting, I'm fine. I'm fine is often, I'm not so bad. You know, when people say figure of speech, I'm not bad. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? You're not good? Does it mean you're not as bad as you normally are? Huh. And what does that mean when you get all the way down? Is there some pain there? And I think one of the trails that is worthy of considering is, if anyone listening, for example, utilizes something habitually, regular, sometimes you notice yourself being there, or you're depending on some type of molecules, chances are there's a pain that's sitting behind that particular molecule, like alcohol or smoking or certain substances, that's yearning to connect with you. And when we don't connect with that part of us that is hurting, for some time we cope, and so much of our life adapts around maintaining the perimeter around not re-experiencing that pain. But is that life? I feel like that's a form of sufferance, where we're unwilling to go into that thing that is so, it's yearning for befriending and reconnection. But I don't feel that it's a cowardice thing. I understand we're wired to minimize discomfort. So may this be the book that encourages you, to remind you that the thing that you think will hurt you the most, very likely when you come upon it, you'll feel through it and you'll be liberated, and you won't be holding all the sacks and all of the things anymore. And I feel that without having, I read a good portion of it before it got re-edited again, touches on much of that. And I love how you write, in particular, the story form, a lot of metaphors that everyone actually will have a little bit of challenge at the start reading that, because the way that we engage with technology invokes scanning for what serves me, what doesn't. It doesn't invoke the imagination to the same degree. But reading, especially when it has us coming upon ourselves, has us paint a picture that may have been distorted because it hasn't been visited for some time. And especially if it's one of pain, one that's been buried away, one that is doesn't have the permission to reconnect with you in a safe way. I feel that the permission that you give to yourself to read at least this book or another one that is along these lines, but may this be the one that you consider it, you will come upon not just scanning the world, but noticing it and feeling into it and then being immersed in it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Not a lot of people are aware of how much pain they are coping with. They don't even think they're coping. Oh, it's just my life. This is just what I do. I just drink on Friday and Saturday and yeah. Sunday and whenever I can.
Yeah.
And it's okay. I just binge watch Netflix when I get home from work and I'm fine. Mm-hmm. I love my life. Well, yes, a lot of people don't have the awareness to understand that the batch of comforts that they built their life around is in reality like a little facade or a little wall meant to keep pain or any deeper exploration away.
Right.
Because it's scary. At the same time, I feel that unless the person is too numb and too disconnected from themselves, which even in those cases, if the person is mentally and emotionally unavailable from their own awareness, the body never is, yeah. pain never is distant, too distant from us. So a person who numbs themselves from their own life eventually gets reminded and reconnected to life through pain, physical pain, illness, yeah. disease. Theirs, or if not that of a close one. The mm-hmm. death or the illness of their lover, their father, their mother, their children sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty of pain. And the first chapter is pain. That's the title of the chapter because it is, well, it's a journey, but I've come to understand that it is a gift, and it is a gift that will not be silenced when you feel pain. That is the most present thing in your life. And the thing that makes you the most present. If you're usually numb and you feel pain, let's say you cut yourself right away, everything in your body is forcing you to pay attention to where the cut is and do something about it.
Yeah.
Same thing happens with life, emotions, relationships, career. The sharper the pain, the more we are almost forced by our body, by our system, to pay attention. Mm-hmm. And that is a gift. So even people who are not aware that they're in pain, it's like, you know, when you're walking down the street and you have a stone in your shoe.
Yeah.
And you can't quite feel comfortable and you take out your shoe and nothing comes out and you keep walking. But, you know, there's something.
Yeah.
Maybe it's inside your sock. Maybe it's like there's.
That's a great metaphor.
There is something that is happening. You cannot see it. At times you may not feel it. At times you may feel that. Yeah, for sure I have a stone, but I don't even know where it is.
Yeah.
But there's that sensation that it is not the way it could be.
Mm-hmm.
Something's quite off. And most people operate in this place.
Yeah.
Sure, they're married, they have some kids, they're making good money, or they're struggling, whatever their life experience is, and go to work, come, they have some friends, they hang out with them on the weekends, and there's something that
so
he's missing.
Yeah. Well, you said this very interestingly. If I can catch you on the way through, because the shoe and the rock in the shoe metaphor is very intriguing, because the rock is the thing outside of themselves that they want to blame as the pain, the source of the pain. But very often it may have been that they're actually been walking in a very disfigured manner for quite a while, and their body's just not able to maintain themselves. But there's a human tendency to want to externalize that thing. Maybe they've had a splinter that was put in a long time ago into their foot, but they want to blame the stone and find that. Mm-hmm. But it is something within, more often than not, that is to be reclaimed. And that stone, when you acknowledge it, you realize that there's a separation. It's not the stone's fault. It was my own responsibility to take action on it.
Yes. Yeah, this is very, very common. You know, recently I was speaking with a very good friend in Colombia. This is a man that I've mentored for, I think, over 10 years now. Great, great guy.
Yeah.
And he's been going through waves in and out of a relationship that has been now consumed to its last. Well, they broke up a bit ago. And it's one of those relationships where things work and there's drama, and then they broke up and they come back together and they're trying to make it work and it doesn't, and back and forth. And by the end of it, there's just so much history, judgment, resentment from the times apart that it's almost unworkable.
Mm-hmm.
And he had broken up with his partner, and the interesting thing is that he lives in Colombia and he attends ayahuasca ceremonies. I invited him many years ago. He had deep connection with the medicine. He invited his ex-girlfriend to attend ceremonies too, and she started going also. They've been going together.
Were they still together at the time?
Yeah, when they were, yeah. Okay. They were together, but at one point she was drinking medicine in a different center from him because they lived in different cities. Long story short, they had broken up already, and he started feeling that she was flirting, or that there was intimacy in the relationship, in the conversation that she was having with one of the shamans. He felt that there was a little too much closeness and too many smiles and sweetness between them. And he called me yesterday or 2 days ago, desperate, saying, "Hey man, I think he may have been doing witchcraft to her." In Colombia, some of these things are common. I think he just probably put some prayer or something in the ayahuasca cup and gave it to her, and then he's poisoning her, and maybe, and he just created this story of why she was flirting with him. Mm-hmm. And I was laughing, and I looked at him and said, "You are honestly more willing to believe that this guy is using black magic to seduce your ex-girlfriend than you are willing to accept the fact that she could fall in love with him." Uh-huh. Because he's a good-looking guy, he's kind, he's sweet.
Yeah.
Like, you're so unwilling to accept the truth of the situation, which is your ex-girlfriend has moved on.
Yeah.
That you would rather blame potential witchcraft. Like, how ridiculous is this? You would rather accept witchcraft as truth before, well, my ex-girlfriend doesn't love me anymore, as the truth.
Yeah.
And very often we do this with life. Like, we're willing to find excuses outside of us so that we don't have to deal with the core of it, because it hurts.
Yeah, because he could have been the hero in that story as well too, where he jumps up and he says, "Hey, this is what's happening, and I'm going to save you from this shaman as well."
Right? That is the role he was starting to play. He's like, yeah. How, like, he wanted to rescue her, and I say, "Well, last year you rescued her from this other thing that happened, and 2 years ago when you broke up, you rescued her from this thing that happened. Just notice your pattern. She does not need rescuing. Nobody is in a place that they didn't choose to be in." Mm. That's hard to accept. But yes, and we all do our own version of that, where there is the truth in our face that we don't want to accept. So it's easier to create a fantasy or believe a fantasy that goes through the sidelines.
Mm-hmm. How did that shift him? Did he go from pain back to purpose?
Yes. He went back to peace, and I think that's at least a clean slate.
Would you say peace is closer to pain or to purpose?
Oh, peace is the blank slate. Far closer to purpose, for sure. But the thing is, peace is a point where you're centered, even if you're going through pain.
Yeah.
It's not that if you're at peace, there's no pain. When I was in Colombia recently, it was Christmas, and for those that have been to Colombia, the food there is really unhealthy, especially during Christmas. A lot of fried things full of cheese and whatnot. Uh-huh. I've been eating very clean for a few years now, and going back to Colombia is always a challenge. This time, grandma's cooking, my aunt, my cousin, I realized I don't want to say no to a lot of things out of being involved with the family. That's what you share there. But I saw that my body did not react well. I started having migraines almost daily for weeks. And I forgot what I was going to say.
You were having food in Colombia that was not so healthy. And then you said, you conceded and said to your parents.
Oh, yeah. So the point that I wanted to make was that.
See, I listen sometimes.
I was in pain, like quite a lot of pain. But I was at peace with it. Yeah. I was in peace and in pain at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I could notice the sensations that were coming through my body. I could notice my discomfort, my judgment, my rejection. Mm-hmm. And there was a deeper layer of, this is okay. And my mom started having also headaches from her own for her own reasons. Yet she was so overwhelmed, and same with my wife. She's like, oh, like maybe she's like checking her temperature every 20 minutes, and maybe I have a fever, maybe I should take some pills, maybe I should do something, and she's suffering her pain.
Yeah.
I was not enjoying it, but I was not dismissing it either. So peace is like the balm that soothes and acts as a lubricant for life.
Mm-hmm.
If you're having a beautiful life and you're at peace, you're just going to receive willingly and openly.
Mm-hmm.
If you're having a difficult life and you're at peace, you're going to move through it effectively,
mm-hmm.
without stress. You'll do what is needed.
Yeah.
Not a good time for sure, but you're not suffering it either.
Right. And I think that brings the title of your book into it, because when someone is in pain but still operating, feeling peaceful through it, there's an element of grace that has them navigate through the pain with greater capacity. Whereas the debilitated individual, I mean, it's all relative, because pain can truly be very significant to someone else, where someone who has the exact same quality and signature is able to adapt through it. But that person who is debilitated by pain versus the individual who is able to navigate through has contact, at least, with this grace that comes forward and then sometimes steps back. But as we call, I feel like it's such an important quality for us to be cultivating regularly, because then we see other individuals with such a compassionate eye, and then eventually, hopefully, we make our way back to having more grace for ourselves and our inner world. Because your inner world is eavesdropping on every single thing that you do, every single thought that you have, action, emotion, feeling. Anytime you reach for something that you know is out of integrity, your inner world hears it, your inner world knows. But in establishing a dialogue with that inner world, I feel that there's a graceful loop that has connectivity throughout. Pain arises, the body doesn't have to signal because you haven't been pushing it away for so long. And what is no longer repressed has greater ability to be assessed and connected to. And I feel that gracefulness is a quality that the whole world could really benefit from right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How, if you were to do a check-in right now, maybe we can both do an assessment. Are you carrying certain pains right now?
I will say yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you care to share?
So, the pain that I feel is predominantly around ways in which I hold a standard for myself that feels beyond where my current experience is at.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what is possible, who and what I can be, who and what I am. And my humanity is confronting sometimes moments of confusion, of compulsion, of making a commitment, a resolution in my mind, and not following through, being disorganized with ideas, with work sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So my pain is that of sometimes noticing, wow, like, I've got so many things really understood in my life, and there are like small points where I feel like, where did this come from? And my reaction is to be to reject it. Oh, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
Or to overpower it. Oh, I'm being a little too comfortable or a little too lazy, then I need to be hyper motivated. I am tired, I feel like taking a nap during the day, then what I need to do is go out and walk and take a cold shower and work out, and right, like just blasting through the system.
Yeah.
Now I am dancing with it. I need to take a nap, all right, I'll sit, I'll explore that option, I'll take a quick nap and see how I feel. Maybe I feel worse because I was just digesting my food and now I didn't sleep and I didn't digest properly. All right, now I dance with it and it stepped on my toes, and now I see, all right, this is not a good way to function with it. I will say that, like, the pain of very high standards and expectations for myself, I feel that life is so brief and it goes by so fast that the idea that it could go by and I could not do all I want to do is painful. At the same time, I feel that any person that does in their lifetime all they wanted to do, they just had very little imagination, very low ambition, and they did not think big enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great thing to die unfulfilled in that way.
Mm.
And it's a sort of unfulfillment that I wrestle with.
Mm-hmm. You wrestle with that?
And I mean, I don't suffer it, right. But I notice it, like, oh, I literally, if I could live longer days, if I could have more time within my day, and I already squeeze every moment, or I try to squeeze every moment out of it.
Yeah.
Lately, I sleep 4 or 5 hours. Since I wake up till I go to sleep, I would say 80-90% of the time really focused, not distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And I still feel there's just so much I would love to explore and do with life that, I mean, it's not possible for a human. We're very limited. So,
well, life is a universal blip, and we, in the context of everything, if 14 billion years is our rough estimate of the time of the universe, which still doesn't seem fathomable,
mm-hmm.
we are alive for a short time in this human experience. And if you were to look at some pictures from the past, you'll see photos of black and white photos, for example, really old pictures. That was only 120, 130 years ago.
Hmm.
I was in the ER and I saw a 93-year-old woman here and a 6-month-old here. And they're one stretcher away from each other. And I'm looking, I'm saying, this 93-year-old was once this 6-month-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a tendency to ask them, like, what's your secret? Though there may not be a secret, but everyone has that little thing that, like, nourishes them as, this is why I'm here. I don't remember what she said, but I remember the smile that she had on her face and the appreciation that she had as well, too. I do think that it's, when we're having the discussion about dreaming, I have come to realize that the foundation that the human experienced is one of the limiting factors for their ability to actually dream in the first place. I'm very grateful that my mom and dad made the world so safe and conquerable that I could dream big and the world was my playground. There are other individuals who have different variations of that, a spectrum where the world is not safe. You have to stay close to the parent. Everything is a hostility, and the human never learns that the world is a playground, and it's not. We don't have time to dream because I need to scan the world to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're having a dialogue, the ownership component can be recognizing where we are, acknowledging the person that we're speaking to this specifically. Maybe they require some massive amount of work for them to reclaim the story that the world is not safe. Because if you're foundational first for that, I don't know what that looks like, because it ends up being the fish with water, that it cannot see it. They just mm-hmm. swim in it. But I see that this is a spectrum of a thing that does happen with humans. And there might even be extra layers to this that I'm sure are going to come arise here, where someone says, hey, you're talking about starting from this point, but I'm actually way back here. So how can you help me? And I think the big thing is going to be inquiry and ownership, responsibility and accountability to navigate through all this. And I wonder how, I mean, one of the first books I ever heard from someone being read together with someone else was David Deida's, what was that? The
Way of the Superior Man.
The Way of the Superior Man. I heard a couple reading that.
Yeah.
And I found it beautiful that they were simultaneously reading it. But it had them leveraging the aspect of what we do, which is scanning, while reading and immersing themselves with a point of accountability, with their partner as well too, which is arguably the person who sees you the most, recognizes a lot of your stuff, and may be the person that enables your coping while you enable theirs. That's another conversation completely. But I'd encourage people, when you are reading this, to consider if the people in your life maybe could benefit from reading that as well too, because when a human being has a transformation, I'm sure you've noticed this, they go back to their communities and their environment, and they almost ask the question, do people need to change around me, or do I need to change and conform to it? And because it becomes so difficult to the transformation they just received, either they regress back, which is probably about 95% of individuals, or 5% of them leave and go find somewhere else where they can find people where that can accommodate the transformation. But you don't have to go anywhere when the community welcomes you as they're in their own transformations as well. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that while you're going through this, your pain point that's bringing you to this book in the first place may be different than theirs, but the invitation is the same. From pain to purpose, with greater amounts of grace and peacefulness in your life. And if you're not feeling that, which at times I myself don't even feel that, I feel that I have the tools to come back to it relatively quickly. And I'm really grateful because actually the man who wrote this book is a person that I confide in and almost is a thematic, symbolic representation of grace, accountability, and the willingness to be wrong and the willingness to reconsider things and the willingness to laugh about the things that we initially found serious but still care all the way through. I'm sure there are many, but if there is one lesson that you want people to really come upon as they're reading this book, that they digest and integrate into their life, is there one that stands out for you?
Well, there's one. The book is one core lesson. It's a journey to arrive to that big lesson. So, I don't want to call it a lesson, but it's a truth mm-hmm. of life. Whether you experience it as such or not determines the quality of your life, and is that ultimately pain is grace, and that is very hard to accept for most people.
What do you mean by that?
Very often the situations that you curse, that you feel they were divine punishment or life being unfair, is actually divine care. Or if you don't believe in
divinity, yeah,
it is life's way of taking extremely good care of you. Mm-hmm. Archetypally, we see this in a lot of different religions, spiritual traditions. For example, there is, I was speaking once with a Christian woman that was very well versed in the Bible. And I think they asked her who was Jesus' closest disciple, who was the most devoted, who was the one that Jesus loved the most. And I think she said it was Judas. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right.
I don't know the story well.
So for those that don't know the story of Jesus is he had 12 disciples, 12 guys that hang out with him a lot of time. And he was one of them who betrayed him, one of them who called the Roman army to come and take him when they were, I think, praying or chatting somewhere next to a tree. I have not read the Bible, but this is vaguely what happened. And then because of that betrayal, they gave the... His name was Judas, his disciple that betrayed him. They gave him some gold and they took Jesus to the cross, to the judge and then to the cross. So a lot of people see Judas as the traitor. But this woman was describing that he was, in fact, his most loving devotee, because he understood the role that everything had to play for the story of Jesus to be alive thousands of years later. And he understood that he had to be because only because he loved him so much, he was the only one that would have said yes to his request, even though it would have broken his heart, because his master, his guru, his teacher told him, I need you to betray me so that the plot, the story can unfold in the way that it has to. And whether that is true or not, I guess we will never know, but to me it rings very true. Even the story of creation, according to, I'm not Christian or religious, but I grew up Catholic, so I know of it. They say that the devil, what they consider Satan, used to be an angel, and he was the most powerful and most beautiful and most loved angel by God. And then he was an angel that was casted out of heaven. My understanding of that is that that which we think is the worst, the source of all darkness and misery, is actually the closest to what we may refer to as God or the source of creation or mm-hmm. the great mystery. Why? Because it is thanks to the contrast that that creates that a story can unfold. So pain plays that role in our life. Mm-hmm. You cannot have childbirth without pain. So for women, it is quite often the best experience of their life and the worst experience of their life. It's physically excruciating for a lot of women. And at the same time, they're like, they don't know what to do with the depths of love that they feel for the child. Mm-hmm. In the community that I work with, ayahuasca community in Colombia, this has happened probably hundreds of times. In my case, it's happened several times, and I've seen this happen over and over and over and over. When people think of drinking ayahuasca, they imagine magical healing is possible, some mm-hmm. sort of miracle. I've been depressed my whole life, and I come out like a new person. I have cancer, I have a tumor, and then I come out without it. Or like they imagine like a magic pill.
Yeah.
And most of the times it's not like that, but not because the plant cannot deliver, but because the person is not ready or willing to see themselves as completely different, as free mm-hmm. from that pain. Yet I have seen it happen many times that a person comes out completely different. You look at them and you can feel their tone of voice changes, the color in their eyes a little bit, the tension they carry in their body is gone. You feel that you're in the presence of a different human being. And almost every single time that a person has an experience that transforms their life so radically and so quickly, it is quite a cathartic experience. And they say it without knowing each other. I've heard this from so many people. It was the worst and the best night of my life. I will not wish it on anybody. I don't imagine worse torment than that. It was the most awful thing I have ever lived. Mm-hmm. And I am deeply grateful. It was the best thing that could have happened to me.
Yeah.
And you have the two sides of the same mm-hmm. coin. How can what really hurt be something that we look mm-hmm. almost in reverence to?
Right.
That is the journey that I want to take people to and through with this book. It's like, how can you, because pain is gonna come. You cannot shelter yourself from pain. That means you're sheltering yourself from life.
Yeah.
What are you gonna do? Big walls around you, not hang out with anybody, not go out because something may happen if you step outside of your home. Mm-hmm. You're gonna create a jail. So you're just keeping life away. You're not keeping pain away, you're keeping life away. So starting from the premise that pain is guaranteed, suffering is optional, pain is guaranteed, what choices do we have? I have the choice that I judge and demonize pain. I feel that it shouldn't be, it shouldn't exist. It's a mistake in a creation that is otherwise perfect. Or the second alternative is I see it as something benign, useful, positive, that works in my favor. Mm-hmm. And if I'm capable of developing a positive relationship with pain, where I embrace it when it comes,
yeah,
then suffering is done.
Yeah,
because there will not be anything that is going to happen in my life that I will not receive willingly and happily. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Beautiful times come. Difficult times, all right, come. Mm-hmm. Right. So ultimately, I don't think happiness is just trying to feel good all the time, but learning to be okay when you don't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually when you're okay with however you feel, inevitably you end up feeling good all the time, because mm-hmm. nothing can, you become imperturbable.
Yeah.
That is the journey that I would love for. If someone goes through the book, really listens with an open heart, goes through the practices and incorporates them into their life, they will come substantially closer to that inner peace,
mm-hmm.
which is unshakable. Nothing can touch it, not physical illness, not death, not anything.
Yeah, I remember reading about an inmate that was wrongfully, a man that was wrongfully imprisoned. He said, I went to prison a free man. I was at prison a free man, and I left prison a free man. And he truly felt that. And I think it was, if it was not 20 years, he taught himself law. He taught himself, and he got himself out of jail. And he said the entire time he had the mindset of a free man throughout. And that was able to have him go through that with, I'm guessing, not I'm guessing, it sounds like absolute grace. What my friend was mentioning too, his name's Michael Parker, was that the things that we remember are he calls them type 2 states of contentment, meaning you don't have contentment right away. You kind of hate the thing in the moment. There's things that you can do that you feel good right away, and it does this thing, and it fleetingly does something to you. But then there's one that, especially when you're in a group of people or you in a hardship that you're going through yourself, you come upon this contentment that comes down the road that you had no way of seeing it, that when you reflect back, you don't remember that happy blip. You remember that treacherous walk that you went through that has you coming upon enlightenment, whatever that word is, seeing yourself, having greater awareness, more peace and grace in your life. And those are the moments, type 2 states of contentment, type 2 states of gratitude, that I find really beautiful. Okay, what are you feeling knowing that the release is imminent in the next couple days?
Feel grace.
You feel grace?
Grace.
Yeah.
The word for thank you in Spanish is gracias. The word for grace is gracia. So I feel that grace is the ability to stand in towards life with gratitude, for gratitude to be your default stance towards life,
mm-hmm.
whatever is happening, whatever life puts on your plate, you receive it with gratitude. It doesn't mean that it's gonna taste great. It doesn't mean that you're gonna enjoy it. It doesn't mean that it's what you wanted,
mm-hmm.
but you can be grateful for that's what you got. That's mm-hmm. the dose you were served. Grace is ultimately the state and the experience that arises within a human being who feels they are touched by the divine everywhere they go. And if there's something that abounds everywhere within us, outside of us,
mm-hmm.
it's pain in many shapes or forms. Developing a better relationship with the pain that we feel inside, that we have felt in the past, and that we see outside of us, it's a doorway to feeling that this is also grace touching us. Grace is a state of total acceptance of life, a state of being willing. I'm willing to surf whatever wave comes, not the one I want, not the one I wish I had, not the one that's going to make me look good, not the one that is for sure not going to drown me, no. Mm-hmm. The wave that comes, that is the wave I'm going to surf. And I'll do my best, and I'll do it with a smile, and maybe I'll drown a little bit and come out up for air and laugh. And sometimes I may think, this is it, this was horrible, I'm never surfing again, and then I come back up and I think, you know what, let's keep going. But grace is that, is becoming willing human beings, not constipated, stagnant, frustrated, half lives because there's a part of life that we reject, that we shame, that we despise. It's not pain that we're keeping away, it's life. It's not other people that we need to forgive if they hurt us, what we need to reconcile with is the part of us that felt taken advantage of, the part of us that felt powerless. That's what hurts. It's not what he said, what she said, what your parents or your relatives did. It's how you feel in relationship to that. I recently heard that trauma is never remembered. It is always relived. We relive trauma when we get triggered. Mm-hmm. We're not remembering it. We're reliving it. And that just means that there's a part of us that was fragmented into the past. A part of us that has not actualized itself with life. So we cannot be fully available to this present moment when a big part of who I am is scattered throughout my history. And it's scattered because I rejected what happened. This is not about right or wrong. This is not about saying that, okay, everyone should suffer. No. But everyone will experience pain, and how you relate to that determines the quality of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Not chasing happiness, but loosening the resistance to pain will ensure that you live a blissful life. Mm-hmm. And that's a life of grace. Buy my book.
Oh, and congratulations on having made it through, bringing it to the recycled paper rectangle that is available for people to receive. I'm wondering if you're going to make an audiobook version of it as well.
I would love to, yes. I'll read something that just came up randomly to wrap up. Play what you're dealt. Play it well. Play it joyfully. Make your best move and trust the rest. At the very least, it will put off the anxiety, worries, and it will make for a more entertaining and exciting game. This is responsibility in action. There I speak about, you know, if you're dealt really difficult cards in a poker game, pretending you don't have those cards, judging, shaming that you got those cards, thinking that it was the dealer's fault, stressing about the bet, about the game, none of that is going to help you.
Very common blame.
Yeah. And the best you can do is like, all right, you need to figure out how to play those cards well. To be deeply attuned and present to others, how they're playing their own chips. Maybe you can bluff them. Maybe you can understand that, you know, maybe you got a couple of, a two and a three, and maybe that's all there is on the table. You don't know. But if you're stressed thinking about everything else, you lose your chance at playing what you were actually dealt, not what you wish you were dealt. And I think very few wins are savored more than those that come with really difficult hands. And the same goes for life. Especially if you were dealt a difficult hand, it is your duty to play it well. And especially if it was difficult, if you learn to play it well, like so much greater is going to be the joy and the juice of, wow, like you almost drown, you almost lose, but you made it through.
Get your copy of Grace, A Practical No Bullshit Journey from Pain to Purpose. Out January 26th on Amazon.
Amazon, yes.
Yeah, and if anyone else wants to connect with Nico, he is Nicholas Cannon, I believe, on Instagram.
At Nico Cannon, then _.
At the end. Yeah, and he has a lot of artwork as well that he was saying that he misses connecting with. I have a tattoo from him as well, actually, right here. Thank you, Nico. Congratulations again, brother.
Thank you, Kai.
I love you and I look forward. There's something about owning the I look forward to the impact that this has. And already I can imagine what it has shifted within you that you got clearer on. You invite people through your sheer embodiment. So that's already a gift, right?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Nico, for taking the time to come and speak about your book, Grace, A No Bullshit Journey of Pain to Purpose. It's available on Amazon today. Get your copy. Consider leaving a review and rating the podcast. I'm not going to tell you what to rate. You do as you feel. And please, before this podcast ends and you go on to the next thing, take 3 to 5 minutes in silence to allow some of the information that you heard to be contemplated, digested, and integrated. To the degree that every experience has a moment to actually have it be processed, it has a greater chance for it to be instilled into your life. I wish the rest of your day and week is beautiful. Take care, remain curious, and don't forget to play.